good clinical performance metric does not lead directly to a good clinical outcome. So sometimes a model will perform a task well, but actually when you implement it in a clinical setting, then it might not have a positive impact or may even have a negative impact.
Welcome to the U+ AI podcast. I am your host, Ranga Sampath. In this show, we meet with people who are leading the change at the intersection of healthcare and artificial intelligence. We discuss their experiences, their challenges, and explore together where AI may drive the most impact. In addition, to enjoy some fun and candid moments with the guests, do check out the U+ AI Vodcast, which is an accompanying video segment to this podcast. You can reach this, as well as all past episodes, at uplusai.com. Enjoy the podcast. Welcome, everyone, to the U+ AI podcast. Today, we're meeting a medical doctor who has spent the last several years exploring data science. This started with a master's degree in machine learning at UCL, and he currently works as a data scientist at Dunnhumby. He's been involved with several AI for healthcare projects, including a model to predict health deterioration at Seracare, and a BMJ systematic review looking at the quality of AI studies in healthcare. Alongside this, he shares his thoughts and experiences of applying machine learning to healthcare on his blog and YouTube channel. He also enjoys coding projects in his free time, and most recently, one of his projects was to code up an alternative to the YouTube algorithm for finding interesting videos. And that's certainly something that we will talk about. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Chris Lovejoy on the U+ AI podcast. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Ranga. Hi, welcome. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, certainly one of your recent projects, which was about building your own YouTube recommendation algorithm, you know, definitely caught my eye. I read the post in Medium and I, you know, went through the code in GitHub, and it was very exciting to go through that. And from what I could tell, you know, you had a lot of good response on social media as well as on Medium. So maybe just walk through us, what made you spend time to do this?
Yeah, sure. So essentially, I'm quite driven by just following my curiosity and following things that seem interesting to me. So a few months ago, like earlier this year, I was watching videos on YouTube, and then I kind of felt that a lot of the recommendations I was getting on YouTube weren't necessarily would have been my first choice, like videos to watch. And so I just had the idea, you know, maybe I could make an alternative YouTube algorithm that would recommend me videos that are a bit more tailored to what I'd be interested in, and just kind of lead to a higher quality of videos on YouTube that I'm watching. Because as somebody who creates videos for YouTube, I was spending quite a bit of time watching other YouTube videos just to sort of get ideas of interesting things that are being made on the platform. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like an initial idea for this project. And then I'm a big fan of people just doing kind of coding projects. I think for me, one of the best ways to learn is just by making projects with code and seeing what you can do. I had this idea and I was like, you know what, let's kind of figure out how I could do this. So I mapped it all out and decided to use the YouTube API to try and get different metrics that I could use, and then fed those all together, created this algorithm that will essentially find videos based on areas of interest and kind of based on my sort of preference for videos. So for example, within the algorithm, I encoded a preference towards videos from smaller channels and videos. Mm-hmm. I put in that videos with high numbers of views from small channels are more interesting than videos with high views from high bit from bigger channels, from channels with more subscribers. So that was one of the things I did to kind of create this algorithm. But yeah, essentially it was just a case of wanting to scratch my own itch of wanting to solve a problem that I was seeing, having fun with it and just spending some time writing up this code. And then I'm a big fan also of documenting what you're doing and kind of sharing that. So in this case, I wrote up a post just explaining the project, explaining the rationale, explaining how I did it. And it became pretty popular and got 100,000 views or so on Medium. And a lot of people emailed me, commented on it and just shared thoughts, which has then been really cool because it's given me a lot of ideas for next step things to do, which for me reinforces the value of sharing your projects in the public space. I didn't really have a kind of strong inclination or idea about how popular this video was going to end up being and how popular this code was going to be. But it was really cool to see the response.
Yeah, I was going to actually ask you more about the feedback as well. So you said that a lot of people, I saw messages on social media, but probably they also sent you messages via DM, and I'm sure in GitHub, probably your repository got forked and people have been trying stuff with it. So what's been the learning from that feedback? What kind of, how would you want to take this further? And what's been, maybe what's been the good and bad of it?
Yeah, I think it's been really interesting seeing different suggestions of next step things to do. So what are a couple of suggestions? I think one was around incorporating comments and different features of the comments into the algorithm. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, the algorithm doesn't look at comments. It looks at other metrics. And I kind of didn't want to just include number of comments because I think it's not really like specific enough. But one of the suggestions that was really cool was maybe applying some sort of like sentiment analysis or some sort of metric, like perhaps about the complexity of the comments as a metric of how valuable the video. If we're saying that in general, videos that have sort of more complex comments or more, like a high level of language within the comments would potentially be mm-hmm. more interest. So that's like one kind of interesting avenue. I've had various messages around how to deploy this in an automated way. So I've learned a bit about different platforms that I could do to do that. I think I've had maybe like four or five different platforms that people have sort of shared, essentially like kind of tailored tutorials on, which is really cool. So a couple of people have done pull requests on the GitHub with ways to deploy it on a different platform. And I've had various messages around that. In terms of future directions, to be honest, this was kind of like a fun part-time project to do. I don't have any plans to do like a lot more work on it anytime in the near future. I think if other people kind of want to run with it and do extra things, which people have been doing, then that's really cool. And obviously I'm keeping up with those and seeing what sort of things people are doing. I currently don't have a huge amount of bandwidth to do more work on it. So I'm very much happy just to let that code sit, let people do what they want with it. And maybe at some point in the future, I'll come back and have a look at it. But for the meantime, I think, at least for me, I've kind of largely wrapped it up. But it was a really fun, interesting project to do. And it's really cool to see the community engaged around it. In terms of your last question around kind of the downsides of it, there's not really anything that comes to mind, to be honest. I guess you could look at it as a downside. To me, it's not really a downside, but the fact that I've had kind of so many messages and kind of people acting on the GitHub and stuff like that, I did feel a bit of a kind of requirement to be messaging everyone and responding to all of those, which I could see as a burden, I think, if I was that way inclined. But to be honest, I didn't really see it that way. So I wouldn't say there was any downsides to having shared it and having had the response it did.
Great. So stepping back a little bit, I mean, we talked about your most recent project about, building a YouTube recommendation algorithm of your own. Tell us a little more about, how you as a medical doctor, got interested in data science and machine learning and AI, and what made you sort of pursue this path?
Yeah, sure. So initially, I mean, I would say going back a little bit, I was always somebody who really enjoyed maths and was kind of interested in computers and how they worked and that sort of thing, even from a young-ish age, maybe before studying medicine. Probably the next degree I maybe would have studied would have been maths. So then throughout medical school, I had this sort of maths interested side of me that never really fully got quenched. That kind of thirst never got quenched, I would say. So we had like a statistics module in, I think, first year, which we did a little bit, and that was kind of fun. And then a little bit of like pharmacokinetics. But I sort of was craving maths out throughout the whole degree, I would say. So then towards the end of medical school, I became aware of the area of data science and of machine learning and AI. And, obviously I heard that there's a lot of potential for this to be making an impact in medicine. I didn't understand it particularly well, but I just followed my interest and I was like, well, it seems quite mathematical. I'd be interested in knowing more about it. So then just went on a gradual journey of learning a little bit here, a little bit there, getting a bit of experience working in the field and just gradually building up that knowledge and understanding. And I would say, it's just continued to kind of build on itself. It very much started with just doing some online courses. I think it was like a Python for data science course. I did Andrew Ng's machine learning course and really enjoyed those. So just had that as a sort of hobby in the background. And then spoke to various different people, ended up doing some work for a startup in South London. And that was a lot of fun. So I ended up doing quite a bit more work with them. And really enjoyed it, wanted to go deeper into it again. So then opted to do a master's degree. And then because I really enjoyed that, I ended up wanting to work full-time as a data scientist and exploring that. So it's kind of been just like an iterative process of getting more and more involved. I would say definitely when I started out, when I was doing that first course, I had no grand plans of working as a data scientist or really getting heavily involved in machine learning. I think I just pursued it as a side interest and a bit of a hobby. But because it is a really interesting area and because it does combine my interest with medicine and the kind of mathematical computing side of things, I think it's just something that I followed further and ended up getting more involved with.
So would you now, are you now more of a data scientist than a medical doctor in terms of the amount of time that you spend on things?
Yeah, I think this is a tricky thing, to be honest, because I would say there is this sort of identity around being a doctor and this whole kind of identity thing. And I think a lot of people who spend time working outside of medicine have this sort of quandary of, am I still a medical doctor if I'm spending most of my time doing other things? And I'm still very much in that phase. I see myself as a doctor, and I also spend a lot of time doing things outside of medicine, and I'm still kind of, I guess, forming my identity in that sense. In terms of at this exact moment, I spend very little of my time working in clinical medicine. I made a decision to spend a lot of time kind of very much focused on going deeper into data science things, with the rationale that I've spent the last 9 years or so training and working as a doctor, and I've only been interested in data science for the last few years, so it makes sense for me to kind of deep dive into that and just build out that sort of skill set and that understanding, which I can then always come back and combine with clinical medicine. But right now I'm in a phase of trying to go deep into the data science things, see how these things are applied in the real world, understand the techniques behind them, and build out that skill set. And then at some point, there's going to be a bit of a decision point where it's like, how best to combine these two going forward. I think, in my experience, or at least the way I feel, is it's not really sustainable to be actively building your skills on both fronts. I think it's more a case of, when you're building out your data science skills, you want to be maintaining your clinical skills. And when you're building out your clinical skills, you want to be maintaining your data science skills, but it's very hard to build both at the same time. Right now I'm in the building data science phase and trying to maintain my clinical medicine phase.
Well, thank you. I think that'll be definitely interesting for people who are interested in clinical data science and they're thinking about both sides of the coin.
Yeah, okay, I hope so.
So, Chris, you've been involved in a BMJ systematic review that looked at the quality of AI studies in healthcare, and I looked up and I was trying to get more information about you. That this study, I think you concluded in June of 2019, And you had some very interesting findings from it at that point. So could you share some of the key findings from that study?
Yeah, sure. So the study itself was a systematic review of all papers that were comparing artificial intelligence algorithms with clinicians. So we had the idea that obviously this is quite a hot topic. There's a fair amount of discussion and hype in this area around how good algorithms can be. And we're hearing a lot of media headlines saying, you know, AI is better at diagnosing retinal disease than doctors, or AI can now diagnose pneumonia on chest x-rays. And these sorts of messages.
Yeah. And many times these are, you know, these come from some of the pioneers in the AI field saying that, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
It's just like, do you really need to train radiologists, or like, hey, dermatologists are in for a, you know, they should really check what's happening. So, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think, and that's not, that's certainly not quelled the hype. So, I mean, a couple of famous examples, like Andrew Ng kind of tweeted out after Stanford did this chest x-ray paper saying, do we still need radiologists to check chest x-rays or something along those lines? And yeah, Jeffrey Hinton kind of made a comment about radiologists not being necessary in, I think, 5-10 years time. Kind of in the midst of all this, we wanted to say, well, okay, what does the current evidence show? What's the state of affairs? So what we did is we looked at all these papers that were looking at an algorithm and comparing it to humans. We were looking at what are some of the characteristics of those studies, like what sort of specialities are they looking at, what sort of countries, all kind of, and what sort of funding they had, the kind of background factors. And then we also looked at how are they designing their studies and how are they reporting their studies? And we used a couple of tools to assess those. So there's some checklists. One of them is ProBAST, which basically assesses the risk of bias of the study within its design and how robustly that's been done. And we used a few others to look at the reporting standards as well. Mm-hmm. And the main takeaway was that, number one, the majority of studies are retrospective and not prospective, which is generally a lower quality of evidence. So retrospective is where you already have all your data and you just train an algorithm and you apply it to that data and see how well it does. Whereas prospective is you have data, you train your algorithm, and then you test that on new data that you collect as it comes in. And it just reduces the risk of confounding bias in prospective studies because you're accounting for kind of more of the variables. So that was the first thing, is that most of them are retrospective. So it's kind of representation of being in an early field. The field is in an early stage, which makes sense because obviously AI and particularly deep learning has only been around for a relatively short period of time. And before you would want to do kind of prospective trials and randomized control trials, you would want a decent evidence that an algorithm is going to work well. So you'd want to probably do a retrospective study first in order to validate that. So that makes sense. It's not a criticism of the field, but it just says it's in an early stage. And therefore, the findings based on these, we should take with a pinch of salt, perhaps. When we looked around this kind of study methodology and the reporting standards, we found that generally there was a pretty high risk of bias in a lot of these studies. And there was also, some kind of issues with the ways that they were being reported. So for example, they would often compare the performance with a small group of doctors. Sometimes they would average the number they would average kind of senior doctors with more junior doctors in the UK, kind of like a registrar level with a consultant level, for example. And that would obviously kind of dilute the clinician performance. And it kind of makes sense to do that if you're trying to show that your algorithm is superior. But actually, that's not really a robust way to kind of quantify its performance. And yeah, if you only have four clinicians who are in your control group, then that's not really representative of the whole medical profession. And you would expect to even see some variation within that. So you're just affecting the kind of validity with which you can say that this algorithm is performing comparably or better than humans. Those were some of the main takeaways. And I guess the central message of the paper was, obviously, there's a lot of hype in the area. There's also a lot of promise, and I think artificial intelligence can play a great role in healthcare, in solving a lot of the problems that we see today. But we just need to be pretty rigorous with how we report our studies and how we design our studies, because at the moment, We're leaning towards trying to prove that AI is better than humans and trying to kind of get that headline of this new algorithm is beating doctors or whatever, which actually there's a potential that you could cause harm with that, because if the media, goes along with this story and then that sort of leads to this hype and leads to unrealistic expectations around the performance of AI, then that's actually not necessarily good for the public. And we might make decisions that lead us to give overly strong weighting to AI algorithms, which actually they are pretty susceptible to bias and susceptible to errors. So we just really need to be careful about how we assess the performance, make sure that we are making decisions based on evidence, and that the algorithms we're making decisions with are not going to make errors that ultimately could have a negative health impact.
So I was curious to ask you, so is there a gold standard of how, these studies must be reported? So for example, you say that there are differences in the way they are reported, and there are differences in the way they are assessed to be at par with human performance, right, in terms of the experience of the doctors or not. But is there some kind of a gold standard established that, hey, this is how a study must be reported? Or I'm looking at something like a minimal set of criteria that, if you're doing such a study, these are the things that you should tick off.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And essentially, there are existing guidelines in place. So for example, in the case of clinical trials, we have the SPIRIT guidelines and the CONSORT guidelines, which are around the designing and the reporting of clinical trials. Mm. But mm-hmm. The issue is that there's some extra limitations and kind of considerations with AI models that aren't taken into account in non-AI models. So those guidelines were written before the age of AI, before these considerations needed to be made. And some of these considerations are around decisions of kind of data, like data inclusion and data exclusion, and how that data is going to be encoded, decisions around methods to reduce risk of overfitting, decisions around how models are going to be updated and how we're going to monitor their performance. Because with a traditional risk model, you'd develop a risk model based on various different parameters, and that would give you some sort of outputs. And then that's fine. You could use that model. It's not going to drastically change its performance as long as those parameters are still being measured in the same way. Whereas with AI, and particularly with deep learning algorithms, it's less interpretable. You don't know exactly what sort of features it's picking up on. And there could be changes in performance if something changes. Like, let's say your algorithm is trained on a particular type of MRI machine, and then you start using a different MRI machine, which is broadly the same, but maybe, I don't know, it has like slightly different spacing between the pixels or the voxels, or it has some sort of slight difference in the way in which it performs the scan, then that could lead to a drastically different performance in the algorithm, and that's going to lead to a change in the performance. So important considerations are, how are we going to implement the algorithms in the clinical workflows? How are we going to monitor their performance over time? How are we going to make sure that we are become aware if performance changes and can kind of intervene in that? So those are all things we didn't have to consider before, but those are things that we do now have to consider. And on the subject of guidelines, we assess these studies based on the old guidelines, but one thing that has been developed since our study is updating of those guidelines for AI specific studies. So we now have the CONSORT AI and the SPIRIT AI guidelines, which were published around September this year, I believe, they take those existing guidelines, but they add in these AI specific elements to help guide authors around that. So hopefully that will also help to correct some of the things that we saw in our study and make them more robust by giving clear guidelines to authors on the sorts of considerations they should make with AI studies.
Right. And what I have also seen is, in many of the papers, I think there's a lot of stress on the performance aspects of it from a machine learning point of view, like, the AUC or the ROC characteristic or the confusion matrix and, the true positive, the true negative, and the false positive, the false negative, and the F1 score and all that. Mm-hmm. But I wondered, if there's a study, that has really good performance characteristics, right? Is that something that is ready? Does that something tell you about the clinical outcomes, whether that would be successful in the clinical workflow?
Yeah, exactly. So that's a great point. And I think the key takeaway is that a good clinical performance metric does not lead directly to a good clinical outcome. So sometimes a model will perform a task well, but actually when you implement it in a clinical setting, then it might not have a positive impact or may even have a negative impact. I think perhaps one example of this would be, let's say we train an algorithm that is really great at picking up specific pathologies on some sort of radiology scan. Let's say maybe a chest X-ray, and it's really good at picking up different pathologies. But then when we implement it in clinical practice, the way that we implement it is that it gives all these alerts for all the different pathologies that it's picked up with pretty like high accuracy, pretty high AUC. The issue with that when you implement that, and obviously this is a kind of extreme example, is if we're giving, I don't know, 5-10 different alerts every time a radiologist reads a chest X-ray, then that's actually going to be quite bothersome for the radiologist and will probably affect their workflow and affect their ability to analyze the chest X-ray. So that's not actually going to be that helpful when applied. Now, we're not about to, you know, make an algorithm that gives like 5-10 different alerts for every chest X-ray, but there's a disconnect there, obviously, between an algorithm that performs really well with an algorithm that then has a positive clinical impact. So we just need to look at the kind of nuance around it of once we've made an algorithm and it performs the task, that's the first step. The first step is that it's able to perform it with a good level of accuracy, a good level of discrimination between positive and negative cases, in the case of something like a diagnostic algorithm, as quantified by the AUC. And then look at, okay, when we implement into clinical workflows, where are we going to put it, is the first question. If this is some sort of screening program, what role is it going to play? Is it going to be the only screener? Is it going to be a second screener alongside humans? How is that decision going to be processed? And then what's the outcome going to be? So if we're doing screening, so there's a nice example of something where this has been done. So in China, they developed a algorithm that will screen for polyps on a colonoscopy. And what they had as their clinical workflow was there would be a colonoscopist who would perform the colonoscopy, and he'd be going through and he'd be looking for polyps. And then in another room, they had either a doctor or an AI who was also reviewing for polyps. And they compared the performance of if you had a doctor doing it and a doctor reviewing it versus a doctor doing it and an AI reviewing it. And they found that the AI picked up certain types of polyps that the doctors tended to miss. And I think it was like adenomas that were maybe particularly small or kind of flat and harder to be seen on the colonoscopy. And that is kind of that shows you that then you have a higher detection rate. So if that's your metric of clinical improvement, then you have a higher detection rate. Obviously, that's not the full story, because then the full story might be, well, what do you then do with those adenomas? Do you then kind of pick them? Do you take samples and then look at those are cancerous, and then you're looking at the detection rate, and that's then the metric. But the question is around what's the impact on the clinical outcomes? Okay, the first thing is that it's able to detect these sorts of polyps based on an image. The second thing is, what does that then lead to in a clinical setting? Does it lead to more polyp detection? Does it lead to more cancer detection? Does it lead to reduced cancer detection? Because maybe, I don't know, hypothetically, there's all these polyps, so the doctor starts sampling more and more of these smaller polyps, and then maybe hypothetically a big polyp gets missed that actually might be cancerous, or a polyp of a certain different type. So then the outcome there is, what is the overall cancer detection rate? That's the outcome of interest. And a good performance metric, a good ability to detect certain types of polyps from an image of the algorithm, does not necessarily lead to that improved clinical outcome. Although often it is, it's a necessity. It's a requirement. What's that saying? It's a requirement, but it's not. It doesn't guarantee it. There's some kind of phrase similar to that. But yeah,
right. So I've heard of this thing. I mean, since you talked about outcomes and actions, this idea of outcome action pairing, or OAP, right? So you do have outcomes of detecting polyps, but do you have actionable things, and do the actions really lead to better clinical outcomes? In some ways, I guess does that reflect what you're sort of saying?
Yeah, exactly. So that's definitely a part of it. A part of it is you might flag something, but then what's the next step action based on that? And actually, if you're looking at clinical outcomes, the action is very relevant, because if you're making alerts and then you ignore them, then you've not really had an impact on the clinical outcome. Whereas if you make alerts and then you make some sort of decision, and that obviously then has real world impacts, then what's the impact of that real world action? And is that positive or negative?
Well, thank you for, sort of explaining the findings of your study, as well as, maybe helping us understand about performance characteristics that are reported in studies, and then what is the bridge from there to clinical outcomes, you know, with the colonoscopy example and detecting polyps. That certainly helps. And so at this point, probably I want to switch tracks a little bit, just ask you about, you know, one thing is so many papers are published in a year, probably hundreds of thousands. I don't know the exact number in terms of medical research and paper. And of course, it's not very easy to understand all of this, right? How does it make sense? And so in that sense, I'm referring to your more recent effort of building explainthispaper.com, right? So I did read some of the papers, and you know, you had explained, you know, in very simple terms, you know, papers like, you know, which predicting macular degeneration using AI and AI diagnoses skin cancer. These are very you know, popular papers in the literature, and you know, this effort had done a great job of explaining it in very simple terms. So could you sort of let us in on what was your thinking behind this and how it started? And, you know, there's this Twitter trend, right? How did it start and how is it going? So could you sort of speak to that?
Yeah, sure. So interestingly, it did actually start as a Twitter thread. So one of my friends just had the idea that maybe with medical research, because it's sometimes pretty difficult to access, as you say, a lot of the papers are long, quite complex. They use a lot of complex terms. And this is particularly the true of complex fields. And it's particularly true of fields where there's kind of multiple different areas of complexity that are colliding. So in the case of medical AI research, obviously you have AI and their algorithms and all these sort of new terms that maybe clinicians are not that familiar with. But then also within healthcare, you have lots of different terms that someone from AI is not necessarily familiar with. So there's some unique challenges that medical AI as a research field represents from this point presents from this point of view. So my friend tweeted out saying it would be really cool if you could have research summaries and that those were annotated maybe by authors who were involved in that research or who, you know, commented on these books of research who had that sort of insights. And he had this vision of, I don't know if you're familiar with the website Genius, which has rap lyrics, and it has those rap lyrics kind of explained in the context of, you know, maybe the rapper is referring to some event or something that if you're a casual listener, you might not be aware of, but someone who's more acquainted with the rap song or the rapper himself can then add that. So we basically wanted to make a Genius, but for medical AI research papers. That's kind of like the plan. That's how it started. It started with this tweet thread, and then how it's going. So we've had a lot of discussion about this over the past several months. We've launched this website, which is explainthispaper.com. And we're in the process of writing a number of different summaries at the moment. I think we have about seven or so live on the site. We have five or six more that are all finished and kind of ready to be published. And we've created a sort of set format of breaking down medical AI research papers in a nice simple format. And we're inviting other people who are interested as well to sort of contribute and help us summarize these papers. And the plan is to create a database where we have all these different summaries of the key medical AI research papers that have been done and continually add to those as new and exciting research comes out so that that can then be a useful resource for somebody who's coming to the area. Maybe they're perhaps an academic who's relatively junior or an academic who's moving into the medical AI field and has previously been doing a different type of medical research. Or even just someone potentially from the general public who is interested in kind of understanding these papers and maybe they don't have institutional access to medical research. This would then be a way for them to, in a much more accessible way, just see what is the gist behind these papers. So they don't have the time or they're not familiar with reading papers, so they can't kind of go fully into that and dive through that. But then we want to make a summary for each of these papers that's just as easy to read as your WhatsApp messages that anybody can just go through and pick up the key points from. That's sort of the vision behind it. And that's something that we've been working on a lot recently and we'll continue to work on. It's a really exciting project. I think there's a lot of different ways that we could take it, but fundamentally the idea is that we take the insights that are kind of contained within medical research and then make that accessible for a sort of general audience which in our heads is sort of like junior academics, maybe informed people of the general public, and just, yeah, make that information more accessible.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly read some papers and, you know, made a lot of sense to me. And I was able to get, you know, the gist of multiple papers, you know, spending 10, 15 minutes totally. Whereas if I had to read the paper itself on my own, I have to spend a lot more time. So definitely that's working. What I wanted to know from you is, I saw the summaries, and the summaries are written by either you or I think your collaborators on explainthispaper.com. So what it takes is probably somebody who is an experienced professional in data science or medicine to kind of digest this information and then present it in a simple form, right? So how do you plan to scale this, right? Because there's with so many thousands of papers coming, hundreds of thousands of papers coming every year. Yes, some of them really bubble up to the top and they're the most important or very highly cited papers. But how do you plan to scale this effort so that you can cover more ground?
Yeah, so I think one part of it is just focusing on the right papers. So obviously there's a huge amount of research going on. But we want to focus on the papers that either present something new that's not really maybe covered in other summaries or is something new in the field. I think one of the key things is just focusing on those top papers and just summarizing those. So we have some systems in place at the moment to sort of select what sort of papers we want to summarize. We also invite people to just suggest papers that they would like to see summarized, which sort of gives us an indication of the interest of the general public or the interest of the people who are using the site. And then from the point of view of sort of scaling and creating more summaries, we're pretty open about people who want to contribute just kind of coming forward and helping us to write summaries. I think there is definitely a certain level of technical understanding that is probably necessary in order to write them. So you would definitely need insight into both medicine and AI and machine learning, because there are always sort of complex machine learning technology within these papers, which in order to summarize it effectively, you need to be able to understand. And then likewise kind of with the medicine stuff as well. So the sort of perfect contributor, I would say, would probably be either somebody who's actively doing research in this area of applying AI in a specific domain, perhaps, and they're interested in writing summaries of a paper within that domain. Or it might also be people doing PhDs, again, applying AI to some sort of clinical problem. Those are probably the sort of prime people we have in mind who could also help contribute. And we've had various people kind of reach out and offer to write summaries for us, which is great. And I think going forward, the first phase is going to be building up a nice database of all the kind of existing summaries. And then once we have that in place and that's a useful resource, we can start moving towards a focus on what are the most relevant papers that are coming out now. What's the way the field is moving and how can we best capture that through the new summaries that we produce?
And what's the way for someone who's listening on this conversation, if they're interested to contribute to writing a summary, what should they do?
So I'd say two things. One is just go to the website, explainthispaper.com, and there is a little box there that you can email us. If you have a paper suggestion, you can do that, or if you want to contribute. You can email me personally at hi@chrislovejoy.me, and I will kind of respond to you and talk about potential papers that we might want to summarize and go forward. I think one thing I'll just stress is there's absolutely no commitment. So if you just want to write one summary and then that's it, then no problem. We're more than happy for you to do that. And if you want to write more, then obviously also more than welcome. I would say check out the website or drop me an email.
That sounds good. And I'll add that in the show notes, Chris. Thank you. So, moving on about, I know that you have a YouTube channel and you are focused on sort of getting this message across of, you know, machine learning in healthcare or data science and AI in healthcare. Right. So I know that you have a lot of introductory videos on how people can get started on this journey. So what have been your learnings from building and, you know, sort of engaging with this community of people who are sort of interested in this intersection of healthcare and AI?
So I would say the first thing is probably just that there is a lot of interest and excitement in this area. I think if the number of people that reach out to me and kind of message me is any indication, then there are a lot of medical students and doctors all around the world right now who are kind of getting interested in this space and understanding how they can be involved. But the caveat for that is that maybe there's a lot of early interest of people who have maybe heard about the area and want to get started, but aren't really sure the best way to get started. So that's one of the focuses of my channel, is trying to help people get over that initial hurdle and start to build their understanding and start to contribute to the field more broadly. Yeah. So the other thing that's really interesting is the kind of earliness of the field. So there's not a clearly defined path by which you can get involved and start building out your skills and contributing to the field. So there are sort of startups and companies that are working in this space. There's obviously people also doing research that are applying AI to healthcare. But because it's in an early stage, there's not a sort of well-defined route for people who want to be a clinical informatician. So that's something that has kind of led me to take maybe a slightly atypical route of then working as a data scientist and doing a fair amount of non-medical related projects to sort of build those skills. Because we're in this early stage of AI being applied to healthcare, there's not yet a clear sort of route that people who are interested can take, which is kind of one reason why I wanted to sort of help provide that in a semi-informal way.
Right. So, I've often wondered whether, is it a clinician who can understand technology and work with it, or a technologist who can understand medicine? Which of those flavors would work better, for problems in the healthcare space?
Yeah, I mean, my opinion on this is that we just absolutely need both. I think as medics, we don't have enough technical experience and expertise to be able to really build these models that are going to be used in healthcare. But likewise, as a technologist, I think there's so many things about clinical medicine that are different to other industries and that are quite unique to medicine, which it's difficult to understand if you haven't worked as a doctor. So I'm a big proponent of collaboration. I think we need to have both people contributing. And I think it'd be very hard to say which would be more valuable. I think it probably depends on the clinical problem. Maybe there's certain problems that you could get away without having a deep clinical insight on. And likewise, maybe there's certain problems where a clinician who has a sort of an understanding of data science could get away with solving without necessarily needing any more advanced machine learning stuff. I think both are essential, essentially.
Well, that's great to know. So thank you, Dr. Chris Lovejoy. It's been a fantastic conversation with you. We started talking about your recent YouTube recommendation algorithm project. Then we headed over to your work in evaluating AI studies and your findings from that, and what could be probably the guidelines for someone to report AI studies and how those will evolve in the future. I think your recent effort of explainthispaper.com is really interesting, and I would definitely encourage many of our listeners to check the website out and go through some of the papers that you have explained in an easy manner, you and your collaborators in the effort. And we also talked lastly about your efforts to sort of build this community of what would I call clinical data scientists, what you've been hearing from people, and how your own YouTube channel, the videos that you put up, are sort of guideposts for somebody who's just entered the waters. So it's been really good. I have learned a lot from following your videos and your work, and as well this conversation. So thank you so much. I'd like to ask you, how can people get in touch with you and follow your work?
Sure. So I think The first thing would be just to drop an email and say hi. So drop me an email at hi@chrislovejoy.me. I read and respond to all my emails. So that's a great way to kind of initially connect. If you want to follow my work, so I have a weekly email newsletter where I just share things I'm up to, things I've read, any kind of reflections about my journey of applying data science to healthcare. You can get that at my personal website, which is chrislovejoy.me, or you can access it on Substack as well, which I think is chrislovejoy.substack.com. So either of those. And then if you're more interested in watching videos, then YouTube/ChrisLovejoy, or just search for Chris Lovejoy on YouTube, then you'll find those. So those are probably the two best channels, I would say.
Well, sounds great. Thank you again so much, Chris.
Okay, thank you for the invitation. It's been really fun. Thanks, Rango.